I was recruiting people who I really had a strong connection with, folks who had not thought about going to college yet, but had all the credentials, academically speaking, that they needed to be here. So going into high schools and talking to folks, and it's like, you know, you have a real opportunity to succeed at Illinois. Talking to students who high school counselors would not give an application to because they didn't think they could succeed. And watching those students apply, become accepted, go to school, graduate, and go on to live great lives was in and of itself a reward.
Diversity and inclusion are important aspects of public institutions, including the University of Illinois. They establish a student body which brings students of many different backgrounds together and ensure that historically disadvantaged students are not alone. Many people assume that the only measure of diversity is taken during the admissions process, a term coined affirmative action. However, this is not true. To ensure both diversity and inclusion, universities take a number of steps, including the recruitment of historically disadvantaged students and supporting those students through graduation. These programs have been built up over decades as affirmative action in higher education began to occur in the 1960s.
When the federal government required that any university that received federal funds had to explain their minority student numbers, which led to more programming to increase those numbers. The universities had to make an effort, or pretend to make an effort, to increase the enrollment of students of color and low-income students because their federal grants depended upon appearing to make a good faith effort to increase those numbers. So I think it was what the Civil Rights Act became after the events of the voter registration as a byproduct was very important.
As the number of students of color increased on campuses, programs and centers arose to support them. Today, the University of Illinois hosts a number of recruitment and retention programs and 8 cultural centers. However, things are not perfect for students of color at universities today. To explore the broad history of the term affirmative action and how universities ensure diversity and inclusion on campuses today, University Laboratory High School students interviewed University of Illinois professors, deans, cultural center directors, and more. We proudly present their stories in Beyond Opening the Gates, Diversity and Inclusion at the University of Illinois. I'm Catherine Delarude. Equality has long been an important American value. However, the country has a long history of both legal and societal discrimination against people of color. American history began with the confinement and decimation of Native Americans and the slavery of African Americans. Before 1965, people of color were excluded from many opportunities that were available to white people, such as higher education. Because of their exclusion from universities, groups of African Americans founded their own universities, which are called historically Black colleges and universities. However, people of color were still fighting for equal access to predominantly white institutions. The civil rights movement of the 1960s aimed to actualize the rights African Americans had been entitled since the end of the Civil War. The success of the Southern Civil Rights Movement led to important legislation such as the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It also helped establish significant laws on higher education, like the Educational Opportunity Act of 1964. Clarence Shelley, former Dean of Students at the University of Illinois, explains the impact of the Civil Rights Act on educational policy.
Some of the outcomes of the Civil Rights Act of 64 were more important to me, those which had to do with higher education, like the creation of the National Defense Student Loans, EOG grants. When the federal government required that any university that received federal funds had to explain their minority student numbers, which led to more programming to increase those numbers. The universities had to make an effort, or pretend to make an effort, to increase the enrollment of students of color and low-income students because their federal grants depended upon apparently a good faith effort to increase those numbers. So then we had programs like Upward Bound, Talent Search. An extension of those programs was the McNair program and things like that. So it was an attempt to make the universities more accountable, to require that they justify receiving federal money, because these were in the early days of what used to be called the Great Society, which was President Johnson's project, which followed right after John F. Kennedy's energy about education. Thankfully, President Johnson stayed with that and even made it better, made it more demanding, which ultimately led to affirmative action and that sort of thing. So I think it was what the Civil Rights Act became after the events of the voter registration as a byproduct was very important.
President Lyndon B. Johnson's 1965 commencement address to Howard University pushed for a level playing field in higher education.
You do not take a person who for years has been hobbled by chains and liberate him, bringing up to the starting line of a race, and then say, you are free to compete with all the others, and still justly believe that you have been completely fair. Thus, it is not enough just to open the gates of opportunity. All our citizens must have the ability to walk through those gates.
As a result of this address, many colleges began implementing affirmative action programs and quotas aiming for a specific number of students of color in each incoming class. These actions opened higher education opportunities which had previously been blocked to minorities. However, this push for equality provoked backlash. In the 1970s, quotas were made illegal, leading to the establishment of a number of different affirmative action programs. Before the Civil Rights Movement, less than 0.5% of students at the University of Illinois were African American. However, after the successful Civil Rights Movement, things at the university changed. In 1968, the University of Illinois implemented a program to increase enrollment of students of color and socioeconomically disadvantaged students. Professor Ronald Bailey, head of the African American Studies Department at the University of Illinois, explains the context of the beginning of the program.
And if you look at the enrollment of black students in higher education, the impact of the Black Power Movement and the rebellions at King's death, the rebellions after Dr. King really created a big surge in the enrollment of black students who then got to these campuses and started to push for changes in the curriculum and so on. So this was a part of what was going on.
James Anderson explains the process of starting the program.
Chancellor Pelterson and others felt that they needed to do something more than just grieve.
Right.
There ought to be some concrete, some institutional response. And so there was agreement, mainly with the black students on campus, that we will increase the enrollment for the fall. It was called Special Educational Opportunities Program. The name 500 caught on later. But it was called SEOP, Special Educational Opportunity Program. And it was not based upon minority status. It was like economic status was the basis. But at the same time, they allowed the students to go out and recruit.
Clarence Shelley explains some finer details of the program.
The students have been negotiating with the administration for a year to increase the number of black students here. So the campus had agreed to admit 50 students for the summer. If they did well, they would be allowed to enroll as freshmen. Of that number, only about 16 of that 50 wanted to stay here. And these are kids who were pretty high achievers, but they were very unhappy with their summer experience. That was in 67. And in the spring, April 4th of 1968, King was assassinated. That's when all hell broke loose. The demands of our students here rose from 500 new students to 1,000. A number, they said, which represented equally the percentage of black people living in the state, this being a state university. So the chancellor, then Jack Peltis, who hired me, agreed in principle, which means he was buying time. And then in the fall of 68, the students arrived, about 560 of them.
Project 500, or the Special Educational Opportunities Program, was partially supervised by Shelley. He expands on the recruitment process.
The black students, the recruiting, we hired our students who had negotiated with the administration to go out and find these people. Now, the students were paid, but they weren't very well trained. They went back to where they came from. Many of the students whom they recruited were not as qualified or as competent or as prepared for the experience as most of our students are. The students identified about 1,300 students. Their recruiting job left much to be desired, you can imagine. They were trying to get numbers in, so they were sending all these applications back, and it was a mess. There was no financial aid forms. There was no housing. All the financial aid had been passed out. There were no advisors here. They were all gone for the summer. Most of the staff was gone. So in the month of July and August, we had to prepare the students for the environment and the environment for the students. The freshman class, we enrolled 560, and we readmitted a lot of students who had dropped out. Because we were convinced that if they had a larger critical mass, they would be more comfortable and perhaps they could do well. And they did very well.
In the summer of 1968, the recruited students arrived. The students moved into the brand new Illinois Street Residence Facility until the rest of the university moved in a week later. Once other students returned to campus, the black students were moved out of the new residence hall and into older campus dorms, or were not told where they would be living. Shelley describes how he organized their arrival and the events that followed.
It was just a mess, but it was manageable, we thought, until the last night before classes started, when they demanded that the chancellor come and talk to them about all their problems. The chancellor didn't come. Went to the south porch of the union to wait for the chancellor, to demand that he come explain this mess. He was advised not to come because, as one person said, we know those black people, they get together like that, they get crazy, so don't go over there. They stayed past midnight. The night before classes started, the police came and arrested 284 of them. I said, uh-oh, well, we're off to a good start here. The largest number of students arrested in the history of higher education. U of I has this great institutional ego where things we have are the biggest, the longest, the deepest, the first, the last, the oldest, we got all this stuff here. We now have the record for having the largest number of students ever arrested at the university. So before classes started, they were in jail.
The arrest of the students was a confirmation for many biased locals and citizens across the country that the students weren't meant to be at the university. Anderson describes the reaction at the Chicago Tribune.
When that happened, you can imagine the news around the country that you admitted more than 500 students, mostly African-Americans. What do? How do they respond? They go, quote, unquote, a riot in the union. And so the local newspapers, the national newspapers, Chicago Tribune and others, as well as state legislators, trustees were saying, big mistake to bring these students in.
However, the program was eventually successful, leading to more consistent enrollment of African-American students. The University of Illinois had exceeded the number of students they wanted to bring in, but the community was still unwelcoming to many black students. Shelley describes the atmosphere at the time of Project 500.
There are places 9 miles from here where they still have sundown laws. If you're black, you can be above the street by sundown. There are towns right around here where I wouldn't go. The freshman class of 1967 had in it about 60 black students. The freshman class of 68, when I got here, we brought in 580. You can imagine the impact of that increase in black faces in this place. It was fascinating, just fascinating. I went on the bus once, a faculty bus, for faculty only. The bus driver stopped and said, you can't ride this bus, it's for faculty and staff only. What I think I've learned is you have all these microaggressions. It is the fine art of shutting down your feelings, because one of the first things you learn as a black person in America is you must be very careful about how you extend your energies. I used to say to students, a black person who isn't crazy isn't paying attention. so many of these small incidents, which in isolation don't seem to be a big deal, over time grow and grow and they kind of fester. What I learned was our students have to deal with that stuff all the time.
Jamie Stinson, the former director of the Native American House, recounts more of these issues.
I've heard stories that African American students had to use the bathrooms in the basement of the Illini Union. They weren't allowed to use the mainstream bathrooms. They weren't allowed to eat in a lot of the residence halls.
Project 500 sparked the creation of the Office of Minority Student Affairs, which still exists today. Dominic Cobb, interim director of the Office of Minority Student Affairs, details its creation.
You should know that the Office of Minority Student Affairs is one of 12 departments within the Division of Student Affairs. Our mission really has to do with student success. We were created in the late 60s to serve Project 500. It's important to respect the history to know that many other students came as well. There were Latino students who came. There were students of different ethnic backgrounds who came into that program. So we were created in part to serve that population, but really it was about making sure that folks who were first generation, folks who were low income, people who didn't have a lot of college experience, to make sure that they could succeed, that they could have people to connect them with resources, that they could have people to advocate. The campus was not a particularly warm environment for those students. When you hear them talk about their experience here, or when you hear African-American students and Latino students talk about their experiences here before Project 500, campus was very difficult to navigate.
As more students of color started to attend universities, cultural centers were created. David Chi, the director of the Asian American Cultural Center at the University of Illinois, describes this process.
The cultural centers began to be popular on university campuses during the Civil Rights era in the late 1960s and early 1970s, primarily African American cultural centers. And they were seen as a refuge from the difficult, hostile environment of the predominantly white universities. Through the years, Latino cultural centers, Native American centers, women's centers, LGBT centers have been created along the way. There were a few Asian American cultural centers that opened in the 1970s, but very, very few. More have opened in the 1990s and 2000s, which is where U of I comes in. The Asian American cultural centers do offer the cultural social support for people of Asian descent, providing familiar cultural celebrations, culturally sensitive counseling and advising, a place to build community with people who share similar backgrounds. Another important mission of cultural centers is to help educate any student and all students about the experiences of that background.
Yes, we're all in this together. You know that it's so easy to see. And if we want to see tomorrow, that's just the way that it's got to be. Lord, that's the way it's got to be.
Affirmative action has evolved much since the 1960s and 1970s. In recent years, universities have embraced initiatives to celebrate and support diversity. These efforts are multifaceted and often begin with a focus on the educational pipeline to college. Many students of color credit dedicated high school teachers and counselors for helping them navigate higher education opportunities. Takeda Bankhead, the former assistant director of the African American Cultural Center at the University of Illinois, speaks about how she was supported by her high school in Mississippi in her efforts to access college.
We were lucky enough. We had a really involved class counselor who really kept us updated on things. And then Ms. Long was our career counselor, so she worked with everybody. And my nephew is a senior now at the same school, and he does not have that at all. Because a lot of the teachers and the counselors who were there when I was there are no longer there. And sadly, they have people who don't give them that same level of attention. So I have to work on them to say, you kind of have to look for it yourself now, because people are not as helpful as they used to be.
Today, there are a number of programs at the University of Illinois to recruit students of color to come to the university. The Office of Minority Student Affairs houses one of these programs, called TRIO. Dominic Cobb describes his experience in TRIO programs and what they do.
As a kid, I was involved in college prep programs, and these programs were from the TRIO programs, which is a family of government-sponsored programs to really expand access to higher ed. I didn't know that language at the time, but I know it now because I supervise those programs. And they really were to target first-generation, low-income, underrepresented students and to help expose them to college, help them with the college selection process and financial aid and transitioning to be ready when they got to college.
Upward Bound is a nationwide TRIO program. Dominic Cobb describes its mission.
Upward Bound is a college preparatory program. Two components, academic year component and a summer component. Academic year, you go there twice a week with your homework and you have tutors available. During the summer, there is a 6-week residential component. So you live on campus, you take courses, and you do loads of homework, but they simulate a college experience for you. So we had responsibilities, we had to do our own laundry, we had to do our homework, we had to get ourselves up and get to school. If you were not able to do those things, there were consequences. If you didn't get to school on time, your free time got restricted. So it gave you an opportunity to kind of understand what college life was. And they also helped you with the college selection process and figuring out financial aid. And we took college tours to see different kinds of universities.
Namika Bates, the assistant director of the Office of Minority Student Affairs, details her and her brother's experience in Upward Bound.
We were both in the Upward Bound program. So when we were in foster care, they paired us with Big Brothers and Big Sisters program. I would say that's probably one of the other bright spots of being in foster care. We got a chance to have connections with college students. So my big sister was a college student, but his big brother was an administrator at Illinois. And he told my brother about the Upward Bound program, which is a college prep program for first generation low income students. And so being in the Upward Bound program, the goal is for students to go to 4-year colleges. So I would say that being in the college prep program is one of the things that, for both of us, was the thing that really steered us toward college. Because even at that time, my mom hadn't gotten her college degree. My father, I think he finished 9th grade, and that's all. And no one else in our family had gone to college. So being in the Upward Bound program, I think, is the thing that sparked within both of us the possibility that we could actually go to college.
The Office of Minority Student Affairs is just one of the offices at the University of Illinois that plays a part in diversity and inclusion. The Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations is in charge of the cultural centers. David Chi explains the Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations' role in recruitment.
As a university, we reach out to many high schools, especially in Chicago, encouraging their students to consider U of I for college. And so those high school tour groups will usually make a visit to our cultural centers of OIR so they can see if they were to become a student here, there would be resources available to help them feel more comfortable and would reflect their cultural backgrounds.
Jamie Singson describes the efforts of the Native American House to bring prospective Native American students on campus.
One of the funnest ways for the Native American House is that when we can bring students to the University of Illinois, something happens because they're here and they visualize themselves here. There are some students that this is like looking in, like I've never been at a university before. We're also inviting Title VII students, which are K-12 students from Chicago. And we're going to bring them so they can see students graduating. Because we know if a student experiences a campus and sees others being successful, they will see for themselves that they can be successful too. So that's one way that we help in bridging those inequities. Maybe you can say it's sort of artificial, but it's really not artificial because you're changing a perception of someone to see themselves as a future of success versus maybe not seeing it all.
Gioconda Guerra Perez, the director of La Casa Cultural, describes what she does in her position.
A lot of people think that you should be focusing on this and that, but my job is to educate them, the campus at large, and at the same time provide the resources and the support our students need from all aspects, not only academics, but socially, culturally, as I said, some of them need to explore their identity. And sometimes they struggle finding out who they are. Do they belong here because of some of the experiences that they have on our campus? Through La Casa, we try to create these programs, educational, social, and cultural programs that are very dynamic, that there is a change of information among our students.
The Bruce D. Nesbitt African American Cultural Center has many programs to recruit Black students to come to Illinois. Takeda Bankhead speaks about a few of these programs.
We have one program called Start Strong in Illinois, and it's a branch of our 100 Strong program, which is a recruitment initiative that takes all Black first-year students and pair them with an upperclassman mentor. And so basically that's their person from the time they enter to the time that they leave the school. So Start Strong basically takes Black high school seniors, and we bring them to campus for a day, and they get to talk to students, they get to go to different events, and they get to spend a whole day here to see what the experience would be like. Most of these students are already admitted to the university, but they just haven't committed. So that's like our final ditch to get them to commit to the university. And then Future Illini is a very similar program that's targeted towards high school Black juniors. Same thing. We bring them here for a day on buses. We let them interact with different professionals and students. And the students take them to these different events on campus. And then they're just like, you know, this is what it could be like if you decide to go. So they give them like their real experiences of what they do. Students will ask about parties and all kinds of stuff. They just want to know what would it be like.
Many departments also do their own recruiting of underrepresented students, including students of color, economically disadvantaged students, and gender minorities in their college or field. Tony Pitts, coordinator of recruiting and special programs at Physics Illinois, speaks about her role in the physics department.
It is my job to talk to prospective students and their parents who want to come here to study physics at the University of Illinois. Having had a college experience myself, knowing in hindsight what I wish I would have known, some of the things that I know now are things that I share with these prospective students and their families when they come to visit the University of Illinois. There are times in college when you just need support. You just need somebody to say, you can do this, and this is how you do it. It's hard now, but this is what's waiting for you on the other side. This is how you get through this. This is how you study. This is where you go for help. If my parents had gone to college, they could have given me that kind of background or that kind of encouragement. They just didn't have that experience. It's not because they didn't want to. I realize, looking back now, it's just they didn't know. I think if I was a man, it definitely would be different, because I think there is a certain level where women are just invisible, especially when I was in school. I think to some degree it's easy to ignore women or to look past them or to not give them an opportunity, or to just see them and discount them and think, oh, well, she's a woman, she's a girl, she doesn't know anything. It's not so much that way now. And I should say that since I do work with college students, that is one of my favorite things about the young women that I work with now, is because they realize that they don't have to tolerate that. They realize that they have something to bring to the table. It's beautiful. Having the experience I have, it's just beautiful watching them blossom and realize their power.
Admissions also plays a role in diversity and inclusion and can be controversial. Christopher Spann describes the process of admissions at the University of Illinois and the widely used holistic review.
What that means is that we're going to look at your academic record, the rigor of your academic curriculum. We're going to look at your ACT score or SAT score. We're going to factor in your extracurricular activities. We're going to look closely at your essay or essays if you choose to opt to write the second essay in this regard. And among these things and a handful of others, we're going to factor in whether you're a good fit for admission to the University of Illinois. So our measured diversity in the state should be our measured diversity at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We also recognize that not everyone has the same educational aptitude and training in this sense. So we have people who apply that just will not be admitted into the university. There is a selectivity index that is tied to it, but it's not tied to it for race or gender or anything along those lines. We see diversity as a compelling interest to the success of not only our university, but our state, our nation, and global community.
Kevin Pitts, the Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education at the University of Illinois, explains how admissions officers look at student backgrounds and opportunities in the admissions process.
We're looking at not only how a student has done in high school and what they've achieved, but we've tried to compare it to what opportunities they've had. because some students have had lots and lots of opportunities to do all kinds of great things when they were in high school, and some students didn't. And so it's not really fair to kind of judge them all by exactly the same standard because some students didn't have a chance. And so by kind of being more, we use the term holistic, but being more thoughtful about comparing achievement to opportunity, that's one way that we provide opportunities for students from diverse backgrounds. In this case, diversity doesn't necessarily just mean skin color or gender. It also can mean socioeconomic.
Although there are many types of diversity, racial identification on applications can be difficult for many students. Jamie Singson explains the complexities of ethnicity and race that are often excluded from applications.
Not only their background, but their racial identification. And I think that's what's important is that in the United States, we create these racial categories. And it's really complicated because we can say American Indian or Alaska Native, but they could be coming from over 567 different communities. I don't even want to say ethnic because they are tribal nations. They are a government relationship of a nation within a nation. But that nationhood comes with a whole history of how they know themselves in the world, how they know themselves in the spatial reality of place. So we can't just say that one program is going to fit all those 567 groups of people. And so when a student identifies as American Indian or Alaska Native, our next big challenge is figuring out what degree are they grounded in their racial identity. Is it someone who just checked it because grandma was Native American to is it someone who checked it because they are enrolled within a tribal nation? And so that's been the big challenge within admissions is to get better information on that racial category. And I think what's valuable as we learn about this for Native Americans is I think it's something that has to be strived for Asian American because how we support a Cambodian student. And there's some differences also in resources. Those Asian countries that their populations have come to the United States as refugees have different resources within the financial aid structure and within the system than other Asian groups. And so how do you identify those students and support those unique needs if they're just in underneath one big umbrella of Asian?
Singson also speaks to the concept of land-grant institutions' obligation to represent the population.
We are a land-grant institution. So a land-grant institution says you are an institution that's for all of the people in Illinois. And so if you look at what the demographic is of Illinois, we know the different percentages. That there's this many, 52% white, on down through the different categories. That those percentages, as we do the census for Illinois, you would think that the University of Illinois should represent, as a land-grant institution, those demographics. From an affirmative action standpoint, you could say, well, why – if Native American population is 2% in Illinois, why is it 0.02% at the University of Illinois? That's where I think one aspect of affirmative action – has an ability to say you should be striving for what your population represents. And part of the challenge is affirmative action is interpretable. In a legal sense, keeps being interpreted. So a lot of admission folks, not only here at the University of Illinois but other universities, have been fearful of striving for getting to these numbers that represent a larger population. And some of the fear is that they could be critiqued for artificially making those numbers increase. And affirmative action doesn't say that you should artificially increase. In an employment context, affirmative action says if you have two employees and you interview them and they're equally capable of the job, affirmative action legally says you should pick the minority. It doesn't say that if your minority isn't as capable as the best person that you should hire them. And I think that's one of the mistakes that people make about affirmative action is – it's not designed to artificially create equity. It's designed to create equality when all things are equal.
Another important component of working towards a diverse school is retaining a diverse student body. The graduation rate for students of color in the U.S. currently remains 14% lower than that for students of Caucasian ethnicity. One major cause of this problem is the lack of a supportive environment on campus. Universities have created a number of programs to ensure that students of color stay in college and feel welcome there. Dominic Cobb discusses what the Office of Minority Student Affairs does to support students throughout their college years.
There are still students who feel like they aren't fully embraced, and we work now with lots of others to make sure the whole campus is welcoming and inviting for students. But that's part of the work that OMSA did and does, but particularly with an eye for making sure that students who are underrepresented, who are first generation, who are low income, who are from what we call low sending counties, which means you come from a county that send maybe one or two people. When students come here without that infrastructure, we want to make sure that they are supported and connected. So we work with marginalized communities across race. People would expect Minority Student Affairs only serves people who are non-white, and that is a misnomer. We serve lots of marginalized communities.
Cobb speaks about his own experience on campus and how Student Support Services, which is a part of the Office of Minority Student Affairs, helped him.
When I graduated and came to the university, I had an opportunity to apply to be a part of the Student Support Services program. And what they provided were resources for me. They made sure that I understood the kind of resources I had in the Office of Minority Student Affairs, which was academic coaching and peer counseling, people who could kind of let you know how to translate your high school experience into college. We didn't know. Those were the folks that kind of helped people like me who didn't have a lot of college going experience, and my parents who had no college going experience either. They could help me kind of figure out how the university worked.
Cultural centers also play a big part in retention. Jamie Singson discusses how the Native American House helps students feel supported on campus, much like the other cultural centers.
We reach out to those students. We do a new student orientation, and we want to get to them early and help them have an advantage to be successful. You know, all the students move in on a Thursday. We want to be working with them on a Tuesday and Wednesday to help them from being shell-shocked, from being thrown in with all the students. And so that's what we want to do, is help them be successful by more of a gradual acclimation. And so that's part of the recruitment and the retention process. That's a big part of our mission, is that we help this 0.02%. There are less than 50 students out of 45,000 that identify as Native American singularly. Not quite 400 that identify multiracially as Native American in another racial category. So those are the students that are largely underrepresented against the 45,000 that we strive to help be successful.
One of the reasons for these retention programs is the difference in graduation rates between students of color and white students. Jamie Singson discusses some of these reasons.
Helping them be successful is really part of the goal, especially for our minority students. And I think that's where I started to have a special concern and special feelings for minority students, because I knew that they struggled. And the data showed that they don't always persist at the same rate as mainstream students. So right out of the gate, a lot of times they are considered high risk. And if the university doesn't approach this well, you could put on the student that, oh, well, you're not supposed to succeed. And that's not a fair psychological position to be in, that sometimes a university, if it's not careful, can put on minority students.
Kevin Pitts talks about how the physics department deals with lower retention rates departmentally.
We work on all things that have to do with student experience. We certainly have a number of programs we've implemented to try to improve student diversity, diversity of the student body. We also do things like job placement and study abroad and academic support. So all kinds of things to help students be more successful. Our goal when we admit students to the university, our goal is to help them graduate. We don't want students to come and pay all kinds of tuition money and then leave without a degree. That's a failure because the students we admit are so bright and talented and well prepared. If they don't leave with a degree, to some degree I think it must be our fault because they certainly don't lack talent.
Affirmative action policies were first introduced to level the playing field and help students of color and economically disadvantaged students achieve equal access to opportunities in higher education. However, affirmative action policies that help foster a diverse learning environment are beneficial in countless other ways. Spann explains why a diverse environment helps all students' mindsets, particularly their understanding of and interactions with a world beyond their limited exposure.
We take such consideration to ensuring that we want to have the right mix of students to have the best outcomes. And if we only had like-minded people like ourselves, it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, that we'll ask the same questions and have the same engagements, but there's really no growth there. We won't learn how to exist with the multiplicity of ways we will have to exist in our global community, in our global village. So I take this very serious. And I think that richness of diversity is absolutely essential. The challenge I have right now, being part of the administration and watching how our administration is playing out at the University of Illinois, is we have increased and maybe even shifted diversity, but we have done very little to include them into the overall basic core business of what we do. And diversity without inclusion is meaningless. You undermine any diversity efforts if you don't include the population.
Kevin Pitts expands on this idea.
I think this gets to a question about what does it mean to have an education. Part of what you learn in school has to do with the subject matter that's going to be on your next exam or the next paper, that kind of thing. But part of it is about how to be a citizen of the world and how to navigate life. And as we go out in the world, we interact with people who don't look like us. So from that standpoint, any opportunities that we can have, especially in formative years, when we're learning how to interact with people and we're learning about other aspects, that's where it would have been a real benefit, I think.
There are different methods used to work towards a more diverse college community. Dominic Cobb discusses how the University of Illinois encourages diversity and why this is so important.
What the campuses try to do is focus on the learning opportunities that are created when you have the diversity of rich perspectives. People who come from rural environments have different perspectives. They see the world differently. When we get together and we can honor and integrate that perspective, we'll come up with an idea that perhaps is more robust. They can point out gleaming kind of failures in our projects. It's like, we don't see the world this way. And the same is true in bringing in people from integrating our international students. We have a huge international student population at the undergraduate level, one of the largest in the country. But what are we doing to make sure that people are meaningfully engaged so you understand what it means to be a student from Beijing or a student from South Korea? And what are the cultural norms there? And how can I adjust myself? Now, this is tough for Americans to operate in a cultural norm that is not my own. Because you very well may get a job working on a virtual team where the leadership is coming from Japan and they don't do things like we do them in the U.S. And it's your job to conform. Are American students prepared to do that? And do we create the opportunity for that kind of learning in these diverse environments? So it's not as much the question of affirmative action and quotas or being an agent in support of affirmative action. It's about how do we truly create a global community? What does that mean? And how do we prepare ourselves to get there?
However far universities have come towards creating more diverse and inclusive environments, there is still a long way to go. Namika Bates discusses the hardships she experienced in being the first African-American female in her field at the University of Illinois.
It hurt me significantly. It did, because, and there's no scientific data to this, because I don't know why no other African-American female has not graduated before me. But I think it hurt me because I feel like I didn't have anyone in the area who felt like they could help guide me along the way. And no one who had experienced this sort of different expectation of me as an African-American woman and the differences in my experiences to sort of help me navigate and negotiate that space.
It's important for students of color to have peers who can help them navigate university spaces because underrepresentation on campus is often a struggle for students of color. Professor Ruby Mendenhall, who is a professor of sociology and African American studies at the University of Illinois, discusses her experience as an undergraduate at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
I liked it. The thing that stands out and comes to mind first is at lunch, like a big group of Black students would meet at, I can't remember the name of the building, but it was where all the food was, like the food court. And so we would just kind of meet and hanging out. And I remember feeling nice about that. But then I also remember, like, in a lot of my classes, like, I was the only Black or wasn't that many people of color there. So I was glad to have that experience at lunch because it felt more like the sense of belonging, I guess what students struggle with now, right? And so that was really helpful. I remember that my African-American study courses, I felt like that's where I learned the most. That's where I got a lot of Black history.
Underrepresentation is just one of the many issues still facing students of color at universities. Another less publicized issue on university campuses is the prevalence of microaggressions perpetrated by other students or even faculty. Gioconda Guerra Perez speaks about how she got her nickname.
If you do not understand what could be a microaggression, then you don't realize that you are being microaggressed. If I look back to 1995, now I share with my students when I either teach or deliver a professional development workshop on racial discrimination, things like that. Now I can see that there were things that at that time, and I see that they are being racist against me. To give you an example, my name, when I say my name in Spanish, is Gioconda Guerra Perez. When I went to my ESL class, I was already an adult. I was 20 years old. My ESL teacher looked at my name and said, oh, I cannot pronounce your name. So you are Gio from now on. She changed my whole name. She changed my identity. And I was like, oh, she cannot pronounce my name. Okay, so from now on, and as of today, my students and everybody calls me Gio. That's not my name. But at that time, I thought, well, she cannot pronounce my name. And then later, I realized when I was taking a class in the sociology department, what was a microaggression? And there was an example given. I realized, oh my God, that experience didn't change who I was, but it was perceived in terms of how others saw me and say, what's your name, Gio? And then I kept saying Gio, 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 thinking, well, they cannot pronounce my name. But they should have made an effort, particularly if you're a ESL teacher. You get people from all over the world try to pronounce their names. Or at least ask the person, you know, I'm having trouble pronouncing your name. Is there a nickname or something that you would like me? And maybe I could have said another thing that I would relate to it. But she just literally changed my name just because she couldn't make an effort to pronounce it.
Professor Rochelle Gutierrez, a professor of education at the University of Illinois, discusses microaggressions she faced as a Latina student at Stanford.
But going to Stanford, I remember within my first few weeks of being there, being asked all the time what my SAT score was. And I remember thinking, I guess this is just what you do in college. Everybody asks you, what's your SAT score, right? And then I realized we'd be eating dinner and other people would ask me. And then I'd think, hey, wait a second, nobody's asking anyone else what their SAT score was. I remembered thinking, this just seems wrong. I remember somebody saying to me, who found out I was on a scholarship, basically said, if your parents can't afford to pay for you to go to this school, you shouldn't be here. You're taking the spot of somebody else. There was this sense that I had somehow gotten in on a quota, that somehow they let some of us in and that we didn't really qualify. I have to back up and say, I was all those things that all those people were that I went to school with. For them to judge me based on A, what I looked like, or B, what I wore, was just wrong. And I would constantly get asked things like, well, what do Mexican people think about? And then they'd complete their sentence.
These microaggressions can build over time and become very difficult to deal with for students of color. Teaching students about race and discussing it helps prevent young people from perpetuating ignorance. Ruby Mendenhall discusses how talking about race in the classroom can be helpful.
Race is something we're very uncomfortable talking about. And so a lot of times it's not in the curriculum as much as it should be. And so that's one thing that we're trying to talk about and encourage faculty to bring it in there. Don't feel like you have to be the expert and you have to be the beginning and the end of the wisdom on race, but to bring it up and to let the conversations flow. But then also at the same time, try to protect your students of color, because a lot of times when those conversations flow, things are said that alienates them, that pushes them away, that makes it very uncomfortable for them to engage in the conversations. And if they feel like they can't say things that reflect their personal experience, then a lot of times they shut down and they aren't getting the education that they need to get.
Another way to help students of color feel more at home on campuses is to create spaces in which they feel comfortable. Mendenhall discusses her own experience with safe spaces.
So even in my research now, we talk about safe spaces, right? Spaces that students of color can go to where you feel the sense of belonging, where you feel like you can exchange intellectual ideas, but you can also say, man, let me tell you what happened to me in class. Or girl, you know, one of the students told me this. Can you believe that? And so this idea of safe spaces are really, really, really important. And so the numbers were low at Northwestern when I was there. But again, I kind of searched out other Blacks, some other groups, and just created these safe spaces where we could talk about both the academic part. Then we can also talk about the experiences of race that we probably couldn't discuss in class.
Although creating safe spaces and educating students about race are important steps towards creating a diverse and inclusive environment for students of color, many schools still deal with issues of underrepresentation. Public land-grant universities, such as the University of Illinois, are intended to serve a student body that is demographically representative of the entire state. However, many public land-grant universities still struggle to represent their populations well. The state of Illinois is 14% Black and 17% Hispanic, yet the student body of the University of Illinois is only 5.2% Black and 9.3% Hispanic. Many students and faculty at the University of Illinois would like to change this. Project 1000, inspired by Project 500, is a movement to enroll 1,000 African-American students in the freshman class by the year 2020. Mendenhall discusses her take on Project 1000 and how it could impact the University of Illinois.
And I strongly support Project 1000. I think, again, as a land-grant university, that the university really should strive to have the number of African-American students and other groups be representative of what their population is in Illinois. And I think that that history is rich. I think that history was successful. I mean, it wasn't without challenges, but it was still successful in terms of the university putting resources behind something and actually seeing it come to fruition. So I think definitely that this is a time for a very similar project. And I like the number 1,000 because it needs to be something that's really huge, that's really massive. So both of those, recruit, increase the numbers, but also really work hard and look at the climate and see what can support people of color and other groups in terms of the climate when they get here so they can thrive through graduation and through their career.
Rochelle Gutierrez talks about the misperception of programs like Project 1000 compared to what they actually accomplish.
This is a similar project to what happened earlier. That project was part of what helped create some of the faculty members who came into the College of Education. What happens is that people wrongly think that diversity programs or affirmative action programs or things like this are one-way streets, that these open the doors and let lower quality people in, and that's like a benefit to that person. I think these programs are programs to try to say there's something wrong with a public institution like the University of Illinois if it doesn't reflect the population that's in this state. It's still primarily a white institution. So I think thinking about these programs where you bring in a whole bulk of students is going to, A, change how the education experience is for other people who attend this university, but it's also going to continue to put pressure on this university to make the experience meaningful and for students to be able to be whole when they're in school. I talked about that when I was growing up.
Recently, many court cases have centered around claims of unfairness in colleges' affirmative action policies. Many white applicants feel that they have unfairly lost out on admission because of their race. James Anderson speaks about one of the first of these cases, Baca versus Regents of California, and how it affected policies since then.
What they ruled was that if a university wants to create a diverse student body, and if the university wants to consider race, but it can't consider race only, if we want to consider race along with other kinds of diversity, the university should be entitled to admit the students to have a cross-section of students. So, for instance, if they wanted to say, we want more students from in Illinois, more students from downstate Illinois, low-sending counties, counties in which there are very few students that actually get admitted to the university. If they want to include that in their diversity plan, they could. If they want to include rural students into their diversity plan, they could. They want to include women in their diversity plan. They can't. The court has said you just can't use race and race alone. That diversity has to be a much broader, much more complex definition than just admitting students of color. And if you admitted them for purposes of academic diversity, meaning these students would enrich the academic environment, that would be okay. But the court reserved the right to say you cannot admit students based on race unless the court decides that there's a history of discrimination and the institution is found liable. And diversity, by the way, is a voluntary program. It's not a mandated program.
There have been many more court cases recently that have again brought scrutiny to universities' affirmative action policies. One of the most recent, Fisher versus Texas, ruled in favor of the universities but maintained that every university's affirmative action policies may continue to be scrutinized in such a way. Since the election of Donald Trump in 2016, the Department of Justice has been ordered to investigate a number of affirmative action policies at universities. The Trump administration took another stand more recently, encouraging institutions not to consider race as a factor for admissions decisions. Affirmative action has greatly changed the student profile of universities over the past several decades, although there is still work to be done. In the coming years, many universities hope to better represent people of color on campuses and make them feel even more welcome. Namika Bates reflects on the progress that has been made and the purpose of affirmative action.
My view is that affirmative action, even if it is something that's sort of couched or termed as diversity, is very necessary. I absolutely do. But to challenge people to think about what we think about when it comes to what affirmative action means. My students are just as qualified, just as prepared, if not more prepared than some students. It really is about making sure that they have opportunities.
I'm Catherine Dellerud. Thank you for listening to Beyond Opening the Gates, Diversity and Inclusion at the University of Illinois. We hope you enjoyed Beyond Opening the Gates, Diversity and Inclusion at the University of Illinois. The program was produced by myself, Catherine Dellerud, with special help from Solomia Jaman, Malika Luther, Lawrence Teresa, and additional help from Maher Adoni, Priya Bhatt, Pomona Carrington-Hextra, Minji Choi, Keshav Gandhi, Sara Hashash, Anya Kaplan-Hartnett, Edward Kong, Annette Lee, Emmy Lukes, Anna Andrachikova, Akash Pardeshi, Sophia Schmitz, Hadley Shapland, Ha Il-Sun, and Natalie Stein. Interviews were conducted by the Uni High Class of 2021 and members of the Uni High Oral History Team. Stories were contributed by James Anderson, Ronald Bailey, Takeda Bankhead, Namika Bates, David Chi, Dominic Cobb, Gioconda Guerra-Perez, Rochelle Gutierrez, Ruby Mendenhall, Clarence Shelley, Jamie Singson, Christopher Spann, and Kevin and Tony Pitts. The program was directed by University Laboratory High School teachers Melissa Shepline and Janet Morford, with assistance from Kimberly Cronick, Jason Croft, Lisa Braltz, and Steve Mork at Illinois Public Media.